Coming up today, why Google might be facing the biggest legal fight in its history, and how a search across 100,000 galaxies is teaching us more than we expected. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to alien empires and anti-troll algorithms. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Katie Collins.
And I'm James Templeton. I like the way you left a tongue twister in your introduction, Michael. Anti-troll algorithms.
I think this is my fourth podcast now, my fourth or third, and so I'm trying to increase the difficulty level.
Yeah, well, why not?
Yeah, I mean,
give it another go.
Next week, I'm going to speak entirely in Urdu, and I don't actually speak that language, so I've got, you know, some stuff to learn, I think.
And also, we'll have to learn it as well, presumably, in order to be able to communicate with you.
And all of our audience.
Yes.
I mean, it's going to be quite a thrill. Stay tuned for that.
So we're still without Liat this week, unfortunately, but she will be joining us next week again for the podcast, hopefully.
And I think we're all looking forward to it. I've missed her calming presence in the newsroom. And we've obviously missed her presence on the podcast too.
Yes. And we'll also be at Wired Health next week, which is very exciting.
Friday the 24th of April. Actually, the speakers list looks really, really good.
Amazing, yeah. It's such a good day. You learn so much about amazing people that are doing fantastic things to help people around the world.
My problem is I'm a little bit paranoid. So when I hear interesting people talk about how to detect new diseases, I just walk out thinking I've got each one of those diseases.
Yeah, not for hypochondriacs.
No, but it will be a great event, and we'll have a lot of coverage from Wired Health on wired.co.uk. So make sure to check it out on next Friday. Right, that's all for now. Let's get on with the news. So, James, the big news this week has involved Google and the EU and the long-awaited antitrust investigation.
5 years in the making, and they finally announced their preliminary verdict. That's easy for me to say. So they decided that Google has unfairly promoted its shopping results. So when you search for a product on Google, type in toaster. The European Union has argued that Google's results are unfairly promoted above other companies.
To bring a common sense approach, why is that a problem? If one's using Google, is there not an implication that you want some results from Google?
Well, most people don't think of Google as giving results from Google. They think of it as giving results from the internet. And this is something that the EU and Google have been going back and forth on, as I say, for 5 years. And Google has made a lot of changes to how it displays its search results, but the EU says it's still not going far enough. This is all about the different ways that Google shows you search results. So when you type in the name of a restaurant, the name of something you want to buy, the name of a famous person, it's what website you then go and use to either make that purchase or find out more information.
Yeah, I suppose it's difficult because you do trust Google to present you with the best option, which isn't necessarily its own option.
Yeah, and while it runs adverts, what this comes down to is its placement and prioritization of other information that isn't meant to be advertising. So if you were looking up a hotel, then you should be able to get results from TripAdvisor and Expedia and LastMinute.com rather than just listings that are displayed by one of those companies over another.
I imagine those companies have had something to say about this as well.
Yeah, it was a lot of their lobbying that got the EU to look into this. And a lot of people think that Google should be a blank directory to the internet, if you like. It shouldn't have any bias apart from in its advertising. And this isn't the first time that the EU's decided to come down quite hard on a major tech company. It's also done it to Intel to the tune of £1 billion for colluding. Well, not colluding, but for giving payments to PC manufacturers to favour its technology over its competitors. And Microsoft was also fined about £500 million a couple of years ago for not giving people a clear choice of browsers that are alternatives to Internet Explorer. So the EU is very keen for big American tech companies to, in essence, play fair.
And what are the potential implications for Google financially?
So it could be fined 10% of its annual sales, and Microsoft also could have been fined that, but it ended up being a much lesser amount. For Google, 10% of its annual sales at the moment is about £4 billion. This is likely to run for months and months, possibly even years. Google has the right to appeal, and that could then end up going to court, and it could take a very long time. And the actual settlement, we might not know what that is for years.
It does seem the heart of this
seems to be an assumption that Google is some kind of public utility. But, I mean, the fact is it isn't, right? Google is a private company which, you know, adjusts and sells advertising on its website for money.
But it's becoming more and more like a public utility. If we're to think of the internet as a human right, then perhaps it's only correct that the company that for many people is the gateway to the internet operates without any sort of bias. But that's very difficult because it isn't like a traditional utility.
No, and you know, and Google is run by human beings who, you know, have their own priorities and business priorities, and it's just going to be a fact of life to some extent, isn't it, that Google search results are going to be influenced by more than kind of ineffable outside justice. Like, you know, there will be some element to Google which will always be subjective.
I think that would be the US perspective. The US has said that the EU should pretty much just get its nose out of Google's business.
Pipe down.
Yes, leave them alone. Whereas the attitude over here is to regulate and to make sure that companies, as I said, play fair.
There's also been a separate investigation into Android, is that right?
Yes, so at the same time as announcing it had come to its preliminary verdict against Google, the EU also announced an investigation into Android to check that Google wasn't doing similar things there with regards to abusing its dominant position in the market. Obviously, this is the biggest mobile operating system in the world, and the EU wants to make sure that it's all being done in a fair way and that competitors have a chance.
So what are the next steps that we're going to see from this?
Lots and lots of documents and legal wranglings and meetings and evidence.
I think in a way it is good that the EU is holding Google to account over this. You know, I think a lot of people worry that Google isn't held to account enough, and you know, to have that body there that's going to kind of step in on our behalf and make sure that we're getting the experience that we think we are. I think that's a big part of it. It's about the perception of Google as a service as most people see it, rather than, you know, necessarily the kind of moral, should you promote your own services. It's people presume that they are getting a fair set of results.
The result
Google.
They see is the best result, yeah. Not the result that someone wants them to see.
Yeah.
I think there's elements of that that are true, but my instinct would still be that there are other search engines available, and that, you know, the fact is that's not true, and people need to understand that when they
this
use Google.
This is what Google argues. It says, we'll go and use Bing, but people don't use Bing. It's such a tiny, tiny market outside of Google that it's so dominant that something needs to be done. That's the EU's argument.
No, but the presumption that Google is a public service is a wrong presumption. And, you know, if the argument is that the public are too stupid to realise that Google isn't just the internet, that's, to some extent, the public's fault. I mean, again, there are alternatives. So maybe we just need an easier way or a change of culture. But Google became a verb for a reason, and that's because Google was really good.
Mm. Perhaps what we do need is just more transparency about, you know, how Google is displaying results, and, you know, slightly more openness and education around this issue.
I think the important thing as well is that this is going to make an awful lot of money for lawyers. And we all know that they need as much money as possible. So great news for them.
Yes, and don't mess with the EU.
So on a slightly larger scale than the EU this week, we heard some interesting news, although not ultimately positive news, about the search for alien life in distant parts of the universe.
This sort of thing almost brings a tear to my eye. Our desperate search for just another little wiggling molecule on another rock.
Well, the interesting thing about this study in particular, this was done by Penn State, and it was the fact that they weren't looking on a microscopic scale, but on the scale of galaxies. So this relates to a theory proposed in the 1960s by Freeman Dyson, who is definitely worth looking up. He's one of the most fascinating figures in cosmology and astrophysics of the last 100 years. But the theory being that if an alien civilization were to exist on the scale of a galaxy, if they could civilize an entire galactic system.
So we're thinking Star Trek kind of thing.
Yeah, like if an alien civilization can last for long enough to exist on that scale and thus be easy to find or possible to find because galaxies are so far away and this happened so long ago, that we would be able to tell by looking at a galaxy, specifically by studying the infrared light that comes from distant galaxies and looking for a larger than normal existence of mid-infrared radiation.
So what would mid-infrared radiation suggest? That they're communicating?
It basically would suggest that they were using the majority of the starlight in their galaxy for their own ends. So either this is Dyson spheres, which are spheres that are constructed around the outside of a star in order to harvest its energy, or just otherwise large-scale structures. And the presumption being that if one were to be a civilization on that scale, you would need to use that much energy and that that would be visible from Earth. So
it's an extraordinary theory.
It's a strange theory, but it turns out worth studying. And luckily, as of very recently, we have a tool that can do it. So the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which is an orbiting satellite and telescope sent up by NASA a few years ago, is able to examine galaxies en masse for exactly this kind of radiation.
And the important thing is, did it find anything? Anything we can be excited about at all?
Well, no, is the short answer. And it's not surprising. You probably would have heard about it had it happened. But what they did find is 50 galaxies with unusual radiation signatures. And a quote from one of the lead authors of the study did use the words could indicate the presence of a highly advanced civilization in reference to those 50 galaxies.
Wow, so it's not been a failure in that respect.
No, and the other interesting thing with the study is that they found a bunch of interesting phenomena we didn't know about in our own galaxy. And you can read about those on wired.co.uk. But so they're going to continue the search. And essentially, I think it's interesting in that we really don't know a lot about distant galaxies as a whole. And so any new method of studying those or looking for unusual patterns amongst a large number of them can turn up interesting things. It might not necessarily turn up the galactic empires of science fiction, but you know, it could turn up things that we don't know about that, galactically speaking, are just around the corner.
Well, that sounds really exciting. I'm interested to see how they're going to continue this study and pursue these 50 galaxies and the potential for life within them.
It's sad in a way, though, because if we did find one of these civilizations, we'd never be able to get there. They're so far away that it's unfortunate that humans will never make contact. But, you know, it is interesting. So they're going to be looking at these galaxies with more sensitive data collection and trying to find out, you know, a little bit more about them. Unfortunately, there was another study this week into fast radio bursts in deep space, which was considered a possible way that alien civilizations might be communicating. And that turned out to be not true. So a bad week all around for the search for alien life.
But the hunt will go on.
That's true. The internet became a slightly better place this week, Katie?
Well, potentially. So I came across this piece of research that was done by Stanford and Cornell universities. And what they've done is they've developed an algorithm that only needs to observe 5 to 10 online posts to predict whether a member of an online community will in future need to be banned for trolling. Now, this study was funded by Google, and it looked at the behaviour of internet trolls over the course of sort of 18 months or so to see what it was that eventually resulted in people being banned. And to do this, they worked with 3 different online communities that had a combined number of users. I think there was about around 1.7 million. And they looked at CNN, the politics site Breitbart, and the game site IGN.
And so what is a troll? What did they find that they tended to do?
Obviously, part of that was kind of defining what a troll was, and I think they came up with a definition that basically suggested that it was somebody who was intentionally trying to, you know, upset, provoke, get a reaction out of other people by, you know, by being kind of mean or controversial, or that was kind of the basic use of the word that they worked with, because when people say troll, they often do mean all kinds of things.
But
also the result of all this trolling behavior had to end with some these people being banned permanently from those communities that they were in.
And they developed an algorithm to spot them.
Yes, they did. So what they did was they looked at various sort of characteristics of the behaviour that would lead to people eventually being banned. And what they found was a very kind of clear set of characteristics to go with. So they from the get-go, they noticed that the quality of the post that was written by these kind of people was far worse than those that are written just generally by other users.
So they're illiterate.
Yes, and also, even more so, they tend to degrade over time.
So they get more illiterate.
Exactly, yeah. So they worked this out by saying that they were basically harder to understand according to standard readability metrics, and they were also more likely to contain language that may stir conflict, including the use of negative words and profanities.
They also posted far more regularly.
Yeah, this is really like crazily more. So the average person, sort of in the time that it would take someone to post 22 different posts within a community forum, somebody that would end up being banned in that same time period would post around 246 different things.
I used to be in a past life, I used to be a moderator on a pretty big gaming
forum. I thought you were
forum.
About to say you were going to be a troll.
No, I was the gatekeeper to try and keep the trolls out. Yeah. And that definitely rings true. These people are seemingly awake at all hours of the day, spouting vitriol onto the internet. Mm. It was incredibly difficult to wade through it all and try and get them to listen to reason.
Yes, well, the thing is, they don't want to listen to reason, and the more that people respond to them, I mean, that phrase that we all know well, the kind of don't feed the trolls thing, is really, really true. Because so not only are they encouraged when people respond to them, but they are also encouraged, particularly when people are overly harsh and when, you know, people come down really hard on them, and they love that. They feed off it, and it just makes them even worse. And they've noticed as well that that trolls are really, really good at luring people into fruitless, time-consuming discussions that are totally off-topic.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
So in the future, are web forums going to be using an algorithm to detect trolls as well as human beings?
Well, this is a part of the problem. So the algorithm that they use is really successful at identifying these people, but they also noticed that one in five people, I think, that they detected was kind of falsely identified as being somebody who would be banned in the future. So they basically said that a combination of this as a tool for moderators to potentially weed out troublemakers and keep an eye on them might be a good idea. And very strangely, at the end of the study, they concluded that the best thing for trolls might not be banning them at all, but might be giving them the chance to compensate and have a discussion about what they've done wrong, and, you know,
therapy.
Quite benevolent attitude, really. So I was quite surprised that was their conclusion at the end of this study. But it is a possibility that this could be used in order to make the internet a better place.
Well, I think one thing with trolls, I mean, from what you're saying about the fact that they post far more regularly, is that they do want to be involved in a discussion, and often they just want to be heard.
Mm.
And if you start listening to them and engaging with them as human beings, oftentimes these people do turn out to be all right. You just need to give them a little bit of time and attention and a bit of love.
Yeah. Oh.
But I mean, the other side of this, I suppose, is that everyone is cynical about online comments on the internet. And obviously at Wired, we have fantastic commenters. But you know, were you to apply this to YouTube, you might find 95% of people who are commenting under videos might be under the glare of the algorithm.
Yes, exactly. And for those really massive communities as well, where it's really hard to keep track of users, and people will sign up and kind of specifically in order to troll, and they might create multiple accounts and that kind of thing, being able to notice who those people are within 5 to 10 of the posts would be really useful for the people whose job it is to moderate those communities.
We have seen this week as well a number of high profile instances of trolling on Twitter. Sue Perkins has unfortunately decided to take a break from Twitter after getting a lot of hassle for something that wasn't even true about her potentially taking over a job on Top Gear.
You definitely don't need an algorithm to spot that sort of stuff.
No, well, but I mean, the fact is that Twitter, for instance, is a huge social network,
yep,
and they can't employ thousands of people necessarily to pre-moderate tweets. So, I mean, ultimately it does have to come down to a technology solution. So anything that can help identify those people and proactively raise flags with moderators is probably a good thing.
And I think on Facebook as well, I know that they have a combination for their reporting system, for example, whereby they use a combination of technology and and people who are there to respond. I think that generally seems to be the consensus, no matter what the public forum that people are using, is that there needs to be a human involved and some technology involved, and working together, perhaps we have a chance of making the internet a better place.
And finally, James, pubs.
Aren't they wonderful?
They are lovely places.
But specifically pubs with science, this is. So there's something called Pint of Science. So think TED Talks, but smaller, nerdier, and with beer.
That sounds incredible.
It sounds like a perfect way to spend the majority of my time. So where can I do this?
Good question. So Pint of Science is now in its third year. It's a festival with over 400 scientists from 20 different universities giving informal presentations about their work in 65 pubs in cities up and down the UK, such as Bath, Cambridge, Glasgow, London, Manchester and Southampton. There's also events taking place in Australia, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, Spain and the USA. So this is a really, really big festival. But I don't know if a lot of people have heard about it. It certainly has a loyal following, but it's getting bigger and bigger. So for £3, the price of a pint in London anyway, you can go along
if you're lucky, you can go along and
listen to a couple of hours of interesting scientific discoveries from the people that are actually working on them.
I think this really caught my attention because a lot of the research that's done in the UK, the scientific research, is actually funded by taxpayer money. And, you know, we're kind of contributing in a small way to helping science. And it's really interesting that we have this opportunity to go along and hear some of what we're helping to achieve with our few pennies of tax money that is going to these scientists. So it's nice. It's a kind of like you're getting some feedback.
And it's accessible as well. And the kind of event that someone might not necessarily, you know, who isn't hanging around research institutions might find themselves at accidentally or go with friends. And
exactly. This is what I spoke to the founder of it, and he said they wanted to make it really, really informal. And the idea is that the scientists afterwards can sit down and have a beer with some of the people that came along and talk about it some more. It's meant to bring it out of academia and out of laboratories and turn it into an informal discussion in a pub.
So you've picked your top three talks that you would like to go to as an example of the kind of things they all look pretty good,
but I picked out three very quickly that caught my eye when I was going through them the other day. So at the Red Lion on Wilmslow Road in Manchester on May the 18th, you can listen to an expert in material characterization who will explain how scientists work on nanometer scales to study individual atoms. And there'll also be a talk from a radio astronomer explaining what happens when galaxies collide.
Cool.
Pretty interesting. Yeah. On the 18th of May at the Colonel Fawcett in Camden in London, a physicist from King's College London will try and work out how many dark matter particles there are in a pint. I'm going to that one because I want to find out.
Is there a prize if you get it right?
Like, I wonder, how many sweets are there in the jar? Yeah. And if you're in Bristol on the 20th of May, head along to the Hen and Chicken to find out about how experts in cardiovascular disease are trying to hack into the communications between cells to save lives. As I said, tickets are £3 each, and you can find out more on why.co.uk or head straight to pintofscience.co.uk.
That's all the news this week. Still to come, we're now just 3 weeks from the 2015 general election, and yet again, it's been labelled the first social media election. But how true is that? And to what extent are politicians actually using social media to connect with voters?
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So, as I said, the election is 3 weeks away and social media is ablaze with discussion and debate. But politicians maybe not using all of the avenues of social media that they could, Katie.
That's right. So I decided as a little treat to myself this week that I would go on Instagram and check out how all of our party leaders are performing in this very important social media atmosphere in which that has more users now than Twitter. So I thought I would check out, see, you know, rate how they were doing, do a little bit of analysis. Turns out that wasn't that easy because a few of the party leaders, including David Cameron himself, has neglected to notice that Instagram exists.
This is madness.
It's such a shame.
I want to see pictures of David Cameron's breakfast.
I was going
to
say, I want to see every moment of his life through a filter of a 1960s camera.
Well, there are some politicians that have noticed that Instagram does exist, and they seem to be using it with varying degrees of success. So the person that's probably doing best is, you'll be glad to hear, James, Ed Miliband.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear that.
He's doing a great job. Like, he hasn't been on it that long, so he's only got sort of 4,000 or so followers, but he does have a verified account. He's been experimenting with video, with a kind of mixture of personal pictures and political pictures, and, you know, it's a kind of a nice combination, good balance. Like, he seems to be getting the hang of it.
So how does that compare to his contemporaries?
Well, so Nick Clegg is also on Instagram. He doesn't have quite so many followers. I think he's only been on there for a few weeks yet. And he's kind of struggling content-wise, I think. Like, he's posting a lot of pictures of himself on the campaign trail, which, you know, it's not that thrilling.
Of a man with a bus.
Yeah, you know, there's a great one of him sort of feeding a fish to a seal. Nice to see what he does in his spare time. Also at Go Ape. So, you know, he's hanging in the trees like a monkey.
What do we want to see Nick Clegg do?
Well, I mean,
the ideal be.
So I think the way that I compared the Instagram accounts of the British politicians was, I looked at the Instagram account of Barack Obama, who is doing a stand-up job of being an Instagram megastar. Like, he has got loads of followers, verified account. He's been on it for ages, and he's doing like videos. He's, you know, sort of two camera little short videos telling people about issues, like, you know, that things that he cares about.
He also has a very cool dog, Barack Obama, and that's always a good thing on Instagram.
Exactly, yeah. And I know that lots of politicians have pets. Why aren't they showing them to us? Like, I love to see people's pets. It tells you so much about a person when you can see what kind of dog they've got. Nigel Farage is also on there. He's being a bit negative for my liking. Like,
shocking.
Instagram's quite a positive place. Like, I don't go on Instagram to, you know, feel like riled, or, you know, I don't want to see controversial stuff. I want to see nice pictures. And he's like kind of poking fun at people, and, you know, it's similar to a lot of his other campaign strategies, basically just pointing out how people are being mean to him.
You feel like he might have a nice line in landscape photography of a nice English field.
Yes.
Unsullied by the European flag.
Exactly, yeah.
Or a pint glistening in the sunshine.
Yeah, yeah. Something, yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking as well, the leaders for the Scottish and Welsh National Party should definitely sort of regram some pictures from their tourist boards and, you know, remind the whole of the UK how beautiful Wales and Scotland are. That, you know, there are great opportunities there for them.
It's not really the place for hashtag long-term economic plan, is it?
maybe not. We'll have to see. But, you know, there is a place for politics on Instagram. We've seen before with the riots in Kiev in Ukraine last year. A lot of them were documented and geotagged, and, you know, a lot of people were following along on Instagram. And, you know, like I say, Barack Obama is on there, and he's been speaking to people, and they clearly are really responding. So, you know, it might seem like a bit of a joke, but actually, I think there is a place for politics on there.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I think politics has come around to social media for a genuine reason, which is that's where the people are, and it's an easy way to get across the message. And the more knowledge we can have about the election and the issues involved, and registering to vote as well, the better. But it's fascinating to know that, for instance, the Conservative Party have famously spent a huge amount of money promoting themselves on Facebook, but seem to be ignoring this other massive social media site, just by apparently forgetting it. And James, this week you've been looking into the history of how politics has responded to technology, and particularly the internet.
Yes, I'm going back all the way to 1992, when John Major beat Neil Kinnock, when the internet had just been invented. There were probably about 10 websites. No one could access them. It was just a research project. It was just about to become a thing, but no one knew about it.
But in 1997, everything had changed, as far as you can as far as you've been saying?
A little bit. Yeah, there were about a million websites when Tony Blair smiled his way to victory. And that was the first election of the internet age. So the BBC had just launched its election website, although it didn't actually have a full website. It only had microsites. BBC.co.uk would launch in December 1997. But it did have fun things like interactive GIFs, and you could also play around with a swingometer developed by Cambridge University, complete with a little Peter Snow.
Oh.
Labour, the Lib Dems and the Tories launched their first websites. They were quite bland affairs, but Lib Dem leader Paddy Ashdown did declare the internet the future of communications and information, while the Conservatives' website had a helpful guide for the young and a game of Spot the Ball. It was best viewed on Netscape 3 or Internet Explorer 3. So it's very easy to think that the internet's been around forever, but this is 1997 and the internet was very much this strange thing that politics really had nothing to do with.
But again, as you move forward through time, by 2001 and obviously by 2005, things were changing dramatically.
Yes, so let's fast forward. 2001, 30 million websites. Wikipedia launched, but despite that, only 39% of people in the UK had internet access at home. And on average, there were just 5,500 connections made across the country each week, which is a mind-boggling small amount when you think of how much of our lives we spend online today.
That does sound extremely small. I think I was probably about a third of those.
Maybe, yeah. It's quite difficult to actually find things from that far back on the internet. You realise how dodgy archiving is. People delete websites, archives are lost, information is removed. It's quite an unreliable medium. But by the time we get to 2005, things are getting a little bit more solid. So there were a billion websites. YouTube and Reddit launched that year, and Labour won again. Individual MPs had also started to build their own websites for the first time. Labour MP Tom Watson, who has always been quite good online, launched his website in 2003, so he was one of the first.
I love how some MPs, you go on their websites and they clearly haven't updated them since they first launched them.
Yes.
It's amazing.
But it also happens to bigger social media companies as well. We discovered this week that a Facebook experiment into democracy has had a tricky afterlife.
Yeah, so if we come to 2010, the last general election really, really was the first proper internet-led general election. We had Facebook, we had Twitter, and there was a lot of discussion online. There were lots of thought pieces written about the social media general election, as there will be this time, and we've been discussing it here on the show. But yeah, there are 160,000 people who joined Facebook's Democracy UK page, with Russian politicians also taking to Twitter. The Conservatives were the most popular party on Facebook at the time, and there was a lot of buzz around it. But as you said, Facebook's early experiment into UK democracy has been abandoned rather curiously.
Yeah, so what has happened to facebook.com/democracyuk?
It's been hijacked. Ooh. So this was the page where Facebook told people where to go and vote, presented the key policies of the political parties. There were videos, interactive stuff. There was an online vote where you could decide which party was closest aligned to your views. It was a really big experiment. Facebook put a lot of money into it and a lot of time. If you go on there now, there's a rather rude picture of some conservative politicians explaining why they're bad eggs.
So it's been hijacked by a specific user on Facebook, and Facebook doesn't seem to mind,
which is quite curious, and it does show the sort of temporary nature of the internet. As I said, when I was looking back to do all of this archiving into the last few general elections as they've been covered online, it's really, really difficult. Stuff just disappears, isn't updated, and gets lost. And this is only 5-6 years ago, and Facebook's flagship Democracy UK page is now just full of swears and rude comments about George Osborne.
It is an interesting thing when historians have to go back in 50 years and try and tell the story of an undoubtedly fascinating conclusion to the 2015 general election. A lot of the material that it's based on might not even exist. There is a question there for archivists as well to, you know, protect this stuff, even as ephemeral as it may seem today.
This is a whole other very, very interesting discussion that I've done quite a lot of reading around as to how do you back up the internet and how do you archive it? What's to say that anyone will understand the file formats that we use in 10, 15, 20 years' time, let alone understand what the internet was in 100, 200 years' time? So it's an incredibly difficult task to make sure that this floaty thing is somehow pinned down so that we have a record of it.
I think we should rush back and print out hard copies of every politician's website. That's your next task for the afternoon.
That's so a lot that. Of paper.
I was actually speaking to Facebook's politics and government specialist for the UK, and she was saying that it's this election, it's much more about how politicians are using those tools to connect with their constituents and have a conversation with them, and you know, talk to them about what they're doing.
It's about hyper-local advertising, isn't it? This is the sort of thing that they're aiming for.
It is, but you know, and she pointed out that, you know, you're right in when you say that the Conservative Party are pouring a whole lot of money into Facebook advertising and that kind of thing, but at the same time, like, these individual politicians have quite often been running their, some of the ones that are doing it really well have been running their Facebook pages for ages, and you know, they've built a really good rapport with the people that are in their constituency, and you know, are showing them videos of, you know, roadworks and why it's important for the local area, rather than just kind of letting the roadworks happen and, you know, not answering any questions about it. They can be really proactive about explaining stuff and why things are happening, and that, I think that's really good.
I think that's a really important side to it. I think on Twitter and Google advertising and whatever, we tend to think of social media elections being blasting out messages to millions of people at once. But if you look at Twitter, not a huge amount of constructive political discussion really takes place. A lot of argument takes place. But the idea of local, I mean, in this country, we still vote for MPs, not for national parties or prime ministers. And local issues do matter. And if we can find new ways to have those discussions which are genuine. Only a small number of people are ever going to go and see their MP in person at a local meeting, but they may log on Facebook and let them know about something very specific and to them that matters, and get a response. And that's a good thing if it can happen.
Yeah, that was actually something that she was saying, you know, the like town hall meetings or MP surgeries. A lot of people, for various reasons, can't even get to them, you know, at the time that they're being held. And even if they do go, how likely is it that they're going to be the person that gets to ask a question? And this is a way for all of those people to take part in those discussions, and for them, the things about their life and their lifestyle not to basically stop them from being part of this way that democracy is now playing out online, which
has certainly come a long way since Ed Balls tweeted his own name
which is definitely the best moment of politics.
I love Ed Balls Day. It's terrific.
So if you want to let us know your personal favourite MP on Twitter, or your personal bugbear about politicians and social media, or whether you think politics really is about social media, or actually it's about making speeches in dusty old buildings, let us know at podcast@wired.co.uk, and we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Do you follow your local MP on Twitter or on Facebook? Because I'm thinking I'm now going to start and I'm going to judge them on how good they are. Content is.
Do you know what? I do, and it's specifically influenced the way I'm going to vote.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is a minor long tale. But so outside my flat, there was a manhole which broke, which clanked extremely loudly every time a car drove over it.
Yeah.
I got in touch with my MP on Twitter, and he shut the road that night. It's a main road, a four-lane road. Shut it and fixed the manhole that evening.
Oh,
my
goodness.
And then I came back and it was fixed. It was amazing. He is Batman for local infrastructure projects.
That's incredible.
I won't say who he is or which party, but he's earned my vote for life. And that's directly from social media.
Well, there you go.
Although, you know, it's impossible to tell whether the fact that I'm a journalist means that he was more likely to respond. I'm very grateful. As ever, we're grateful to our sponsor, Audible, for supporting the show. Downloading your free audiobook at audible.co.uk/wired is always a good idea. And this week, why not try Work Rules by Laszlo Bock? Everything you need to know about how Google works and how you can be one of the lucky few from 1.5 million annual applicants to actually get a job there. Worth a listen. And as Katie mentioned at the top of the show, Wired Health takes place next Friday, April 24th. Huge amounts of content will be online at wired.co.uk. Check it out. There'll be video, reports, all kinds of interesting things from hundreds of the world's best experts in health and health technology. And we'll see you again next week.
Goodbye.
Bye. We'll